Have you ever walked into Five Guys, ordered a regular cheeseburger, and made the complete rookie mistake of asking for a large fry?
Oh, yeah, every single time.
Right. Because if you have, you know exactly what happens. They take that oversized cup, they fill it up to the brim, put it in the brown paper bag.
And they just go crazy with the extra scoop.
Exactly. Just for good measure, they take this giant metal scoop of extra fries and literally just dump it right into the bottom of the bag.
It's the best part.
It is. You walk out carrying this overflowing, grease-stained bag of salty goodness, thinking, like, there is no way I can handle all this.
Yeah, it's totally unearned.
Completely unearned. And that overflowing, crazy generosity is the exact image Pastor Kent Wagner used this weekend to describe God's grace.
Yes.
So welcome to this deep dive.
Glad to be here for this one.
Today, we're acting as your personal guides to take that massive theological concept from Kent's sermon over at Harmony Christian Church and, make it bite-sized.
Right, getting you totally prepped for your Connect Group discussion this week.
Exactly. We are going to dig into the actual mechanics of that message.
Huh.
And specifically, we're going to look at that jaw-dropping interview Kent did with fellow church member Josh Walls.
Oh man, what a story.
I mean, a guy who literally had to lose his career and his physical strength to finally find true freedom.
Yeah, and moving from that, abstract theory of God's blessing right into the messy, chaotic reality of a real human life is what gave this weekend's message so much weight.
You really did.
Because Kent didn't just let us sit comfortably with the Five Guys blessing as this neat little metaphor. He immediately examined the conditions of that blessing.
Right, he took us straight into the book of Luke.
Yeah, Luke chapter 6, verses 37 and 38. And it just reveals how incredibly countercultural God's kingdom actually operates.
And Kent broke down those words of Jesus using that old Sesame Street game. You know, the one, like, one of these things is not like the other.
Oh, right, yeah.
Because Jesus lists off four specific commands there. First, do not judge. Second, do not condemn. Third, forgive. And fourth, give.
Right.
And I have to admit, sitting there listening to Kent list those out, that fourth one completely stopped me in my tracks.
Because it feels out of place.
Totally.
Yeah.
Like, not judging and forgiving, those make sense together. They're about holding back a reaction.
Yeah, withholding something.
But then Jesus throws giving into the mix, which is this totally outward, active thing.
It does seem jarring at first glance, but there's this really profound, almost psychological mechanism linking them all together.
How so?
Well, the first three commands are focused on releasing a relational debt, right? Not judging, not condemning, forgiving. Those are all internal exercises of restraint.
Right, which is hard enough on its own.
Oh, absolutely. Kent pointed out that a majority of pastoral counseling revolves around just the sheer difficulty of that internal restraint, like specifically forgiving someone who has done something horrible to you.
Yeah, it's not easy.
No, it's not. But giving is the physical manifestation of that exact same internal posture. They both require relinquishing a debt.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, so forgiveness is releasing an emotional debt someone owes you, while giving is releasing a material debt you think the world owes you.
Wow, that's a really good way to put it.
And Jesus groups them together because honestly, absolutely none of these four things are our natural biological state.
Oh, definitely not. In our default human condition, we do not naturally withhold judgment.
No way.
Like, our brains are literally wired to categorize and judge threats instantly just for survival. We don't release people from condemnation. We don't naturally forgive. And we are certainly not naturally generous.
Especially towards strangers who haven't earned it. We lean so heavily into self-preservation.
Which Kent illustrated perfectly with that Kentucky stoplight analogy.
Oh my gosh, that was hilarious.
Right. He talked about sitting behind a guy at a stoplight. The light turns green. The guy just sits there. It turns red, then green again.
And then Kent gives him a little honk.
Which, if you are from Kentucky, you know is a massive cultural faux pas.
You just don't do it.
You don't. And the guy's reaction wasn't just to drive away. He proceeded to drive around for 2 miles, aggressively flipping Kent off.
2 miles.
Yeah.
But it's true, right? When we get cut off or corrected, our nervous system just spikes with adrenaline.
Yeah, we definitely don't lean toward grace. We lean toward road rage, colorful sign language, and, protecting our ego.
Exactly. And Kent focused so heavily on those unnatural reflexes to show that they actually reflect the very heart of God.
Because God doesn't operate in that fight or flight mode.
Right. Kent made this crucial theological point for us. God doesn't condemn us to hell. He simply allows us the choice of which kingdom we actually want to build.
Wow.
Yeah, he holds off judgment, he forgives graciously, and he is shockingly generous. So the actions of a Christian are meant to be like a kid copying their dad.
Which is why Kent noted that the Greek root of the word Christian translates to little Christ.
The historical context of that is so fascinating, too. It originated in the ancient city of Antioch, and it was actually used as a slur.
Wait, really? A slur?
Yeah. The locals were mocking the believers, basically calling them miniature versions of that crucified guy.
Oh.
But the early church just embraced it because it was deadly accurate. They were actively trying to mimic the unnatural sacrificial reflexes of Jesus.
Okay, let's unpack this.
Yeah.
Because if my natural state, like my literal biology, is hardwired to hold a grudge, to hoard my money, and aggressively protect my own interests.
Yeah.
Doesn't Kent's idea of simply choosing a new life sound a little too easy? I mean, if I'm hardwired to flip off the guy at the stoplight, how do I actually override my own internal operating system?
It's a fair question.
Because doing these unnatural things just to get that overflowing bag of fries feels like I'm trying to earn something that goes against my very nature.
Well, doing these things, forgiving, giving, not judging, doesn't earn your salvation. You aren't saved because you managed to muscle your way into doing them.
Right.
Rather, when you do them, it reflects that you are actively living in your salvation. It's the evidence of a transformed heart, not the currency to buy one.
So it's a reflection, not a payment.
Exactly. Jesus is describing what a disciple does, not what a disciple pays. It requires positioning yourself toward a totally different way of life and yielding the control you think you have over your own survival.
But recognizing that biological hardwiring is one thing. Actually overriding it is another entirely.
Oh, for sure.
And to see what that override looks like in practice, we have to look at Josh Walls. I mean, his background is so relatable to anyone in our church who's just trying to hustle and provide.
Yeah, 10 years as a firefighter.
Working those brutal 24-hour shifts. And then instead of resting, running his own lawn care business on his days off.
His original goal was just textbook self-reliance. The ultimate American dream.
Build wealth, retire early.
Exactly. Have the big house, the nice cars, and basically do whatever he wanted, whenever he wanted. He was aggressively building his own kingdom.
And the psychology behind that is so common, right? We equate financial wealth with a fortress. Yeah. We think if we just have enough money, we're insulated from the chaos.
And on Instagram, on Facebook, his life looked absolutely perfect. He was hitting all those financial goals.
But the reality inside the walls of his home was incredibly dark. He admitted he was miserable.
Yeah.
He was actively pushing his wife and his kids away to chase the dollar, operating under this assumption that the best way to provide for his family was purely financial. Work, work, work.
And that is exactly where the illusion of control begins to crack.
June of 2022.
Yeah.
The first major crash.
He was in a head-on collision coming home from the fire department.
And it was severe. Like, it required 2 neck surgeries at a specialized hospital in Boston.
Right. And it caused major blood flow issues to his arms. It totally ruined his ability to work above his head, which is devastating for a firefighter.
Forced him right onto light duty.
He was suddenly on a crash course to lose the very fortress he had spent years building. And, you know, he grew up in the church. His parents raised him to know God.
He even used to pray for victims at accident scenes early in his career.
Exactly. But over the years of chasing his own kingdom, his heart just became calloused. So when his life spun out of control in 2022, instead of turning to God, he gripped his controllables even tighter.
Yeah. He told Kent he would literally go look at his bank accounts and investment portfolios just to find security.
Because it was the only domain where he still felt he could dictate the outcome. Even when he was hurting from the accident, he'd physically force himself onto a lawnmower to keep that side business running.
Hearing Josh say he would check his investment portfolios while his family life fell apart, it really reminds me of a hydroplaning car.
Oh, that's a great comparison.
Right. You know the tires have lost contact with the road, you feel the back end slipping, but your brain panics. So you just grip the steering wheel harder and harder.
And it doesn't do anything.
It doesn't give you traction. It just tires out your hands while the car spins anyway. Why is our immediate reflex to double down on our controllables when the universe is actively proving we aren't in control at all?
Because it's terrifying to admit we're powerless. For Josh, giving up control meant giving up his entire identity as the provider and the protector.
His faith was at absolute zero.
He admitted he was running away from God, from Harmony Christian Church, and from his family. clinging to that bank account was a survival mechanism, because in a hydroplaning life, a number on a screen feels like solid ground.
Even if it's a total illusion.
Exactly.
And that illusion was about to be violently shattered in May of 2024, almost 2 years after the first crash.
The metal building incident.
Yeah. Josh is out in his metal building on Burton Pike. And if you live around here and know that area, cell service is spotty at best. Inside a metal building. Non-existent.
He was completely isolated.
Just backing up his trailer in an old truck that didn't have a backup camera.
And he's still on light duty, still dealing with the neck issues, still stubbornly trying to run this lawn care business. He backs up, and he's about 6 inches off from the hitch.
And instead of just getting back in the truck to adjust it, he decides to use his hip to nudge the trailer over.
Which is so dangerous.
A heavy double-axle trailer loaded with 3 commercial lawnmowers. When he pushes it, the weld on the trailer jack completely shears off.
Oh, maybe.
The heavy hitch drops, ricochets off the back of the truck, and violently pins Josh's leg to the concrete floor.
And the medical reality of what happened in that split second is just harrowing. He suffered an open tremolar fracture.
Which means what exactly?
Well, to put it in perspective, your ankle has 3 main bones forming the joint, the malleoli. Josh broke all 3 of them simultaneously.
Oh my God.
The downward force was so violent that his ligaments actually tore pieces of bone away, and the broken bone itself punctured completely through his skin.
Wow.
It was a catastrophic structural failure. Every single ligament was severed in half except for his Achilles tendon. He was trapped, actively bleeding out, and completely alone.
He tried to use his belt as a tourniquet, right?
Yeah.
But he couldn't even get it around the exposed bone to stop the bleeding.
And his phone had no service. Even the SOS satellite feature failed.
And meanwhile, his 4 and 6-year-old kids are inside the house with a babysitter, completely oblivious, just watching Paw Patrol.
Thank goodness they couldn't hear him, honestly.
True. But it meant no help was coming from the house. So Josh comes up with his desperate system. He bangs on the side of his metal truck 3 times with a broken jack and then yells for help as loud as his lungs will allow.
Over and over.
For 20 minutes until he was on the verge of passing out from the pain and blood loss.
And then the miracle neighbor steps in.
A woman who lived directly across the street up on a hill, a neighbor he had never even met.
The statistical improbability of her being there is staggering. She was supposed to have shoulder surgery a couple of weeks later, but felt this overwhelming sense that she needed a break.
So she randomly took that exact day off work.
Right. She felt a sudden urge to sit out on her front porch and have a cup of coffee. And that is when she heard the faint sound of him banging on the truck.
She came over, found him bleeding out, and literally saved his life by using a floor jack to lift the heavy trailer off his shattered leg.
Yeah. And that detail about the church gift basket later on is just incredible.
Oh, I got chills when Kent shared that part.
Me too. When she came to visit him during recovery, Josh and his wife gave her a gift basket that a friend from our church had put together for them. It had a coffee mug and a journal with some specific scriptures printed on it.
And the neighbor completely broke down crying because out of the thousands of verses in the Bible, those happened to be her 2 absolute favorite scriptures.
And the church friend who made the basket had no idea.
None at all.
Yeah.
It's a massive testament to God orchestrating the smallest details right in the middle of our chaos.
But the aftermath for Josh was brutal. Medical retirement from the fire department, a $90,000 pay cut.
Completely lost the lawn care business.
By every metric of the American dream he had been chasing, he was ruined. Yet, standing on that stage with Kent this weekend, he called it the absolute best thing that ever happened to him.
Here's where it gets really interesting. Josh said he was baptized on a concrete floor. As he lay there, bleeding, realizing his own strength had failed him, he finally surrendered.
He finally stopped fighting the hydroplaning car.
Exactly. But it raises this wild paradox. Josh says giving up control was the scariest thing he's ever done, but it was also the most freeing. Does it really take getting pinned under a heavy trailer and losing 90 grand a year for us to realize that holding onto our own kingdom is actually a prison?
For a lot of us, yes. Because our natural state is so deeply ingrained, we'll fight to the bitter end to maintain our perceived safety. We have to be brought to the end of ourselves.
Josh talked about a revelation he had reading the book of Judges in his Connect group, right?
Yeah, he read about 2 biblical leaders who ruled for a combined 40 years. And the only thing the text records about their entire legacy is that they had a whole bunch of donkeys and kids.
Donkeys and kids.
That's it. And Josh realized, if you live your whole life stressing and hustling, and all history can write about you is your bank account balance, which is the modern equivalent of having a lot of donkeys, it means absolutely nothing.
It's an empty legacy.
True legacy, true freedom, is found only in a relationship with God and relationships with people. He traded his $90,000 illusion of control for genuine peace. He finally let go of the steering wheel.
It's just so powerful. We've seen God's incredible grace in Josh's life through this violent tearing down of his kingdom. But Kent didn't just end the sermon with Josh's story.
No, he left the congregation with a really jarring illustration to explain exactly how God goes about rescuing us.
The calf roper story.
Yeah. Kent talked about his childhood mentor out in Kansas, this tough old rancher named Kelly Evans.
Right. Kent went out there to learn how to rope a calf.
Yeah.
And after Kent finally gets the rope around the calf's leg, the calf goes down in the dirt and starts fighting wildly, just completely terrified.
And then Kelly Evans, this seasoned rancher, just bum rushes the calf, tackles it into the dirt like a linebacker, rips its front legs up, violently pulls its mouth open, and takes this long metal device out of his pocket.
Shoves it deep down the calf's throat, pulls a trigger, and then casually gets up and walks away.
And Kent is absolutely horrified. He's asking what in the world just happened.
And Kelly simply says, "I was giving it its medicine."
Because a cow doesn't speak English. You can't just hand it a pill and explain the benefits. You have to wrestle it to the ground and force it down its throat to save its life.
Which brings up the ultimate question of the sermon. Is that who Jesus is?
So many people picture God exactly like Kelly Evans. An angry, forceful God who violently tackles you, rips away your fun, and force feeds you salvation against your will.
They view church as a place where you get wrestled into submission. But Kent was so clear. God is not a calf roper.
He does not tackle us. If he were a calf roper, he would have tackled Josh Walls years ago, long before that first car accident.
But God kindly, patiently waits. He let Josh run as far and as fast as he wanted, building his little empire, exhausting himself.
God waits for us to end up in the desert of our own making. He waits for us to realize we're thirsty, and then he invites us to come for living water.
He doesn't force the water down our throats. The trailer accident wasn't God tackling Josh. It was just the natural collapse of Josh's fragile kingdom.
And God was right there in the rubble waiting for him.
So I want you to think about your own life right now. Are you fighting God like a calf fighting the rope? Do you assume he just wants to ruin your plans and take your money?
What if he's not holding a rope at all? What if he's just standing in the desert waiting for you to realize your hydroplaning car isn't working anymore?
And realizing that God is an inviter, not a tackler, completely changes why we gather as a church.
It's what Kent's pastoral dream for harmony is built upon. He outlined three specific desires. First, find your purpose. Like the people in our church who actually find deep joy in building complex Excel spreadsheets.
Something that literally makes Kent want to puke.
Exactly. God wants to use your unique wiring for his kingdom. Second, find your people.
Which is exactly why we do connect groups.
Precisely. Find your people so you aren't trying to survive the desert alone. And third, grow as a disciple. Grow into that little Christ who naturally forgives the guy at the stoplight and gives generously.
When you walk into your connect group this week, it's so tempting to just give the sanitized Sunday school version of your week.
Oh, for sure.
It's easy to sit in the circle and pretend your kingdom is doing just fine. But remember Josh's vulnerability. Be honest with your group about where you're gripping the steering wheel too tightly.
The church is meant to sit in circles, not in rows, precisely so we can help each other let go of that wheel.
Here's a final thought to take with you before your small group meets. We've talked a lot today about Josh giving up his kingdom. But think about the neighbor on the porch.
Yeah, she had to give up her perfectly peaceful morning off to get involved in someone else's bloody, messy chaos.
She had to leave the comfort of her porch to lift a trailer off a stranger. So whose kingdom are you willing to step out of this week to help lift the weight off someone else? Have a great connect group this week.